Hello and welcome to On Sacred Ground on the LMC Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and if you're tuning in online and having technical issues, remember that you can listen to the show by calling in via your phone or Skype to 657-383-0525. To those of you who are listening in the chat room and listening live at blogtalkradio.com, welcome and thank you so much for tuning in. This is our sixth episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting live at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, on this January 31st, 2015. And today we actually have very special guests, the founders of Baladeh Black, a collaborative with a merged vision for social justice and spiritual empowerment. We'll also hear the musical stylings of Soli Rose, blending West African, flamenco, and blues rhythms toward taking us all home. But before we get that, we'll be beginning today, as we usually do, with a reading from Earth Prayers from around the world. 365 prayers, poems, and invocations for honoring the earth, edited by Elizabeth Roberts and Elias Pamadon. And today's reading is actually a poem by famed saint, Saint Patrick, who actually has a very special place in New York City, where I live, where he is the patron saint of the Archdiocese of the Catholic Church here. And it goes, "At Tara today, in this fateful hour, I place all heaven with its power, and the sun with its brightness, and the snow with its whiteness, and fire with all the strength it has, and lightning with its rapid wrath, and the winds with their swiftness along the path, and the sea with its deepness, and the rocks with their steepness, and the earth with its darkness. All these I place by God's almighty help and grace between myself and the powers of darkness. I arise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of oneness, of the Creator of creation. I arise today through the strength of heaven, light of sun, radiance of moon, splendor of fire, speed of lightning, swiftness of wind, depth of sea, stability earth, firmness of rock. I arise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness of the Creator of creation." Thank you again so much for joining us. And as I said before, we have special guests today, the founders of Baladeh Black, and I'm going to be having them on right now to talk to us about their work. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
We're honored. Wonderful. Thank you.
I'm truly honored that you would accept my invitation. I know that you are both so busy doing really, really incredible work. So being able to have you as actually my first guest on the show really, really warms my heart. And you are Nia and Samia. And where are you in the world? What place has been blessed by your presence?
We're in Phoenix right now, Phoenix, Arizona, in the beautiful Southwest.
I have a very, very special place in my heart for the Southwest. I've only visited there once, but, you know, I'm sure you know that there's sometimes that you feel throughout your life a very strong emotional connection to a place you might not have ever been. What's the weather like there? In New York City, we are experiencing some extremes.
We've heard. Yeah, it's pretty moderate here. It's certainly not you know, sunny or warm at the moment. The skies are kind of white, but it's certainly not extreme.
Yeah, we've had some good sun over the last few days. So, but yeah, it's this area is really, really wonderful and a lot more, ecologically diverse than one would imagine, I think. So, and it's just really, it's really a wonderful experience being here in the body, you know. So, it feels very home-like to us, I think, in an interesting way, even though I don't know how long we're going to be here. We tend to be nomadic, so we've been moving around for several years now. But, you know, that's the life I think we chose, so we'll see.
Well, I can relate to that completely. It's so interesting feeling tied to many places, and I think that people like yourselves and myself, we might be people who are sort of close to the land or land-based or earth-based philosophies, but rather than that leading to us staying in one place, that leads to us traversing the world tremendously, which can be such a blessing, but it's a really unique way of living.
Exactly.
Yeah, especially in this society, which is constructed against it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I did.
The amount of times they go to USPS. The amount of times I go to USPS and change my. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm saying the amount of times I go to the USPS and change my address is out of control.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, we have a concept around here that we call grounded nomadism, and it's related to basically, in summary, what you just said. You know, we can talk about it more, but that's the idea. So, anyway, yeah.
Well, kin hearts, indeed. So, tell me a bit about this project. That I know, if I'm not mistaken, it's been going on for about a year now, and I plugged this in my last episode as one of the big announcements because I just love what it means. I love what you're doing. Ballet Day Black. What is Ballet Day Black? And I know that people can get more at Ballet Day, BALADE.black. But in your own brief terms, how would you explain what has led to this and what it is?
Great. So I'm gonna just briefly, you know, summarize everything with a tagline, and then we can talk a little bit more about the history and where it actually comes from. But, you know, our tagline or our, you know, I guess our short mission is, you know, find your song, build your boat, and take us home. And it's pretty straightforward in the sense that, you know, the idea is that we need to know who we are as individuals, why we were born, what we were born to do. And, you know, the build your boat aspect is more about manifesting that purpose in the physical realm, which is deeply connected, obviously, and reflective of that inner self and, you know, the spirit that's come here. And, you know, so we're providing strategies and techniques that cover more of a radical kind of, I guess, entrepreneurship, and I'll really trouble the definition of that word later on for us. But so that's one. And, you know, at the end of the day, we see that as a way to kind of reorganize the systems that we live in. And so it's a kind of a communal organization kind of engine that's, you know, a little bit more long-term and sustainable in our vision. And so that's why we've got that kind of end statement about, you know, going home, because that's the journey we're embarking on with those two kind of aspects of the work. So yeah, that's the quick version. Mia, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to say that that it started out in many forms, and that we kind of have ended up with this, but that, you know, that it started off as a project of kind of knowledge gathering for us, for Samia and I, and we used to call it the Elders Project. And it start, you know, we were going to coming, this idea of nomadism is just rearing its head. You know, we were going to travel around the Americas, and starting with the U.S. And, you know, gathering knowledge, doing exchanges with various elders, and because we see indigenous elder knowledge as subjugated, and we also see in the U.S. the presence of so much diasporic indigeneity, you know, from African Americans, from Chicanos, from various other diasporic populations, that is often also doubly subjugated because they don't necessarily have that label of indigenous. And so, we, you know, we said this is really important and it really needs to be elevated and honored and valued. And so it kind of started from that place. And what has ended up happening, I think what is really cool about what has happened through its evolution into Belle de Black is that we're still kind of doing that gathering, except we're doing it in community. And we're allowing, we're creating a space for people all over the world to kind of share that journey with us. So we're kind of learning along with everyone else.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm just blown away by the vastness of this project, but also the vastness of its origins. That this isn't something that you came up with one day and then it became what it is today, and what you're doing is that this isn't something that's been churning and building over time. This has been sort of an accumulated vision that you've been cultivating over a long period of time, and then when it was ready for it to be what it is now, it became that, and that someday, I'm sure it'll be something even different. Someday it'll be something different and even more new than it is today. You've said so many things that are so close to my heart. Actually, many things that I actually did not expect you to say, and I'm sort of like wondering where to even begin. But I'm going to start with this idea of how Belle de Black approaches what I would call sort of the idea of the soul's purpose, doing what we've come here to do, and maybe even prefacing that with being who we have come here to be. And I would say as individuals, would you agree that that's what Belle de Black, part of what Belle de Black is doing, especially I know with this new project you're having with Chief toward people having a sense of groundedness in who they are and why they came here, like literally why they incarnated, why your ass is breathing.
Exactly. Yeah, would you like to? Well, I'm going to say, you know, something about that. I guess I'll start off a little bit. I tend to be a little more, technical in the way that I think about these things, and then you'll get the depth with Nia. So I'm going to say, you know, I've been really, really obsessed, you know, with the idea of purpose for such a long time. And it's so deeply connected to, I guess, for me being queer, you know, and I felt like, you know, when people used to say to me, you know, you know, oh, you're just, you know, differently gendered, and, you know, why do you have to explain that away? Why is, you know, it's not important. Why is not important, you know? And I guess as a young scientist and, you know, artist and all of that, I was so intrigued by the fact that, well, my spirit kept saying no to that statement. It's like, that's not true. There is a why. You may not know what it is. I may not know fully and completely what it is. But, you know, I'm going to discover some of that, and I'm going to, you know, there's, you know, it's going to fit into a larger universe, a larger picture, a larger work that needs to be done here. And so I feel like that kept me alive as a young queer person, because I kept asking that question, and eventually as I, you know, traveled and left my home and was able to connect with other individuals, and one of the most one of my major influences as a young person was, you know, Malidoma Somé's text about the gatekeepers, and I had a moment where, you know, a tear-filled, you know, very deep moment, you know, of kind of you know, recognition where I realized that everything that I am is so deeply purposeful, you know, and especially some of the things that we're denied being, or, you know, we're not allowed to be, because those are, that speaks to the things that are the most dangerous, that are, you know, that are resurfacing, that are, you know, reframing, that are, you know, breaking things down that need to be broken down. And so, you know, the concept of purpose for me is, as I say, you know, often the fundamental organizing principle of our world. And unfortunately, it doesn't take center stage anymore, even though I know that, or based on our understanding, me and I's understanding of indigenous, you know, cultural practices and earth-based practices, that is the fundamental organizing principle. Everything that you do is built around honoring and amplifying every one's purpose in the community, and every, you know, living, you know, being, be it plants or, you know, trees or, you know, the rock or whatever it is all about understanding that. And that's what leads to understanding interconnectedness, and what leads to having a balanced and just life, and all of those kinds of things. And so, yeah, you know, that's the summary, I guess, of it altogether. Not a summary, but yeah.
Yeah, I think this is such an important embodied example that Samia's giving. You know, my name Nia means purpose. So I've had such a vexed relationship with this term for my whole life, it seems. And I think that just as purpose is kind of relegated to being insignificant, it's also often taken to be self-evident. And so I think that we're kind of working against both of those philosophical trends to kind of keep the intentionality in it, but also keep the mystery. You know, I think that what Samia is articulating is really important to think about for queer of color bodies, for other socially marginalized folks, right? People of color, indigenous folks, trans folks, right? That this reclamation of purpose is actually incredibly dangerous, is really incredibly dangerous for the existing, you know, institutions of power, for social systems, because with purpose, there comes a vision for the world, a clear vision for the world, which is something that through normative systems of education, normative religious institutions even, is, right, in so many ways colonized out of us. And coming back to my own ancestry, one of the fundamental tenets of chattel slavery in the transatlantic slave trade is that the will is separate from the body. Mm-hmm. The body is segmented from the will, and the body is segmented from the systems which would help to decode and understand that will. And so, I mean, you want to talk about colonial, it's like a fundamental objectifying act. And so, you know, we're really interested in kind of the deeper implications of what it means to reclaim purpose, and also still completely mystified by the process, which is why I feel like it's a lifelong exploration. You know, if you go into looking at any indigenous system, I mean, we've been looking most at Yoruba, but, you know, in terms of thinking about how purpose happens and what that has to do with the relationship with the ancestors, what that has to do with the space of the unborn and pre-birth choices and all of that, it's an endless kind of spiral of mystery. And yet, at the same time, we believe that there is enough that we can hold on to here in this world about it that could fundamentally shift our world.
I agree entirely, and I think that what you're doing by inviting people to engage at what you've said is really, around the world, a basic organizing principle that does not take center stage anymore. This sense of purpose. Who am I? Why am I here? And I know that, Nia, you literally just used the words pre-birth choices, and I love that you use that word, because it plays a huge role in my work and in my life as well. The decisions that we made before we got here and how acknowledging those decisions, remembering them, engaging with them through exercises and such as the ones that I'm imagining Chief Louisa Teach, the Yoruba priestess that you are currently collaborating with, is putting on the table for people to explore. Amazing. And I know that people who might be listening might be thinking, gosh, this is a lot. But this is a radical system. This is a radical way of understanding the system, because really what we're in is we're entrenched in a system, and then we go la-da-da-da-da-da down that road. We've been given a map, and then we are 100 miles into that map, speaking of the in what we've been told is important in our world. What we've been told is of importance, of value, of what we need to be paying attention to, and then we're 100 miles in on the map, and we look around, and from a subjective standpoint, we're saying, I'm lost. I don't have the things I need to continue going. And, of course, we look up at a billboard, and it's an Axe body spray that's telling us, no, you're fine. You know, there's a Target there's a Target down the block that you can buy the next thing that you need at. And you're saying, no, we have to go back to the beginning. We have to go really back to the beginning of what we consider to be even important in life, of what this our whole lives are founded upon. And that's going to take radical change, and it's going to take really radical organization like the one that you've founded. I also want to come back to two things that you mentioned. First of all, I just have to say that you're mentioning of, and excuse me if I'm wrong, diasporic epistemologies, diasporic ways of knowing, as doubly subjugated because they don't get the indigenous label on them. And am I correct in saying that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's like, whoa, because that's literally stuff I'm writing about right now. So thank you so much for pointing that out, the ways in which diasporic being people who have left one place or been taken from one place and moved to another, and that the same attention gets put onto sort of First Nations wisdom and indigenous wisdom doesn't get to be put on what would then sort of be considered diasporic folklore. So that is amazing. And the fact that you are factoring that in to your work as you are exploring indigenous epistemologies, sort of first people's ways of knowing, and including elders in that work from indigenous and diasporic communities, sort of reframing the whole, is amazing. And this brings us right into what I've mentioned a couple of times, your work with Chief Louisa Teach. Is there, what can you say about how this collaboration started? Did you know this incredible activist, artist, teacher beforehand? Where did this start?
So, yes, it feels like a lifetime ago. we were, Samia and I were in class at Stanford in Sheree Moraga's class. It's a good time to say now that Sheree Moraga has been a mentor figure for us and has really deeply shaped a lot of this thinking that you're hearing. So we were in her class, and you'll love this title if you liked diasporic indigeneities. The title of the course was Indigenous Identity and Diaspora, People of Color Art Practice in the Americas. And so Louisa Teach was a guest artist. So during the course of the class, we had several guest artists come in and read from their works, lead us through rituals and various other activities. We had Linda Hogan, we had Louisa Teach, we had Sharon Bridgeforth, we had Joy Harjo, many folks from across the country coming in too. So it was a tremendous opportunity. If people watch the Spirit of Activism class, they know that when I was at a period of deep, deep loss and lack of clarity in my life, when I was in the Berkeley Public Library, Chief Teach's book, Jambalaya, literally fell on my head. And I had to catch it and say, huh, okay, great. This is exactly what I needed. This is exactly what I was looking for, right? And so after having had that experience, I read Jambalaya. I devoured it. It changed things for me. It really helped me understand myself as an African-American woman and all of the various spiritual systems that go along with that, right? And so when Shri Maraga announced that Tish was going to be one of the speakers, I said, oh my God, can I pick her up? Can I please pick her up? And can I please take her to class, right, so that I could get some time with this incredible person? Because I was just so stunned by the gravity of her vision that ranged all the way from spiritual inheritance to the political and didn't ever see those things as separate, which is exactly the vision that I needed to be affirmed because it was a vision I felt inside. And so I picked her up, and we ended up, I think, going out to dinner with Sheree and her after class. And you know, after that, I think we got her contact information and started bombarding her.
She made us work.
She made us work. We wanted to get divinations from her, Dilogun divinations within the Yoruba system. And, you know, I think we were doing some sort of barter because we couldn't pay the full price. And so she made us clean out her library, her enormous, incredible library, and reorganize all of the books in, you know, subject and theme and author order. It's so funny because the first day that we went there, we showed up in our whites, and we thought we're about to get our reading, we're about to get our divination, and we would do the work after. We thought, you know, like we'd arrange them the other times. But she was like, what are you wearing? Because
for this big cleanup job.
Yeah. She's like, you got to work first. Like, hello. So it was really, it was a teachable moment from that very first, you know, interaction.
Right.
So that's how kind of we started, if you want to continue.
Mia's absolutely right. And you know this guy from, you know, experience, I'm sure. That is the way, you know, elders teach in a
of
kind
course.
Of, right, in an embodied sense. And the lesson is never what it seems. It's never what you think it is. And, you know, you get broken down in different ways. And so that was, you know, I felt like we did some of the hard labor, you know, initially, and then, you know, I think that led to kind of being a repeated lesson for us with Chief Tish is, you know, some of the most, as I'd like to say, I think some of the, again, fundamental, I think we reclaimed that word fundamental. It's being used so much right now, but it, you know, essential and fundamental, kind of the basics of what it means to be embodied and in spirit, you know, and because she does, you know, the way she works is, you know, every little thing that you do with her is, to a certain extent, you know, a teachable moment, also, you know, so profound if examined, if you choose to examine it, you know. So I think that we, you know, and I wrote an email recently about that to the list, you know, that folks are on. We tend to think of spirit or magic or some of these things is kind of disconnected from the body or separate from the body to a certain extent, and, you know, as a result of some of the traditions we've been raised in, unfortunately. But, you know, it's her day-to-day being with us was, you know, reaffirming in an embodied way that relationship, you know. And I had a very interesting, for me, I've always had a chasm, I guess, between or some sort of disconnection, you know, between kind of spirit and what is what I call, like, you know, entrepreneurship or business, you know, what is the market, you know, understanding the market. And in my first Dilogun reading, that came up so strongly. And I was basically, you know, scolded, you know, and told that this was some of the work I needed to do in the world, and I couldn't kind of reconcile the indigenous, you know, commitment, the social justice commitment with that, you know. And so she's been incredibly formative for me as a thinker, you know, and as a you know, being, in terms of, you know, how to then take the challenge of that purpose and, you know, be able to figure out a way to bring those seemingly kind of disparate parts together, you know. So And I had a similar, you know, relationship to the work as Nia, to a certain extent. But and a lot of, you know, that's it, you know, with her. What do you mean? You know, she's all about the fundamentals. And so if you're looking for, I don't think you can do some of the deeper work without the fundamentals. And then we get so, like, woo-wooed by, you know, the cool, you know, stuff, which I think you can do past, you know, I think good character and power are two completely separate, you know, things, you know, and in Yoruba, good character is highlighted far above and beyond power, you know. So, and if you don't have that, then you're not living in your purpose. And so, you know, these are the two kind of things that we've been toying with and, you know, playing with. Anyway, that's a long-winded answer, but yeah.
Well, no, totally. It's all making complete sense. And what's sort of standing out to me is how this divination that you received from Chief Louisa Teach via Dilogun, which I do have some familiarity with. I do believe it's working with cowrie shells, 16 cowrie shells, that, and the way in which they fall on a mat, usually, speaks to one of the Yoruba myths that sort of brings back to you a reflection of your current state or the story that's being told about your life. And this divination that you received from her was integral to your own understanding of your own soul's purpose.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, interestingly, ultimately, in the business, which she's a huge part of, you know, so
yeah, it's really like the beginning of
totally.
It all. That session was the beginning of it all.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is also this divine, you know, things coming together in this beautiful way. There's an element of soul's purpose in which I would say my own cosmology and way I live my life, that it's seeking us out. It's not this far off thing that we necessarily have to go chasing down, that usually the signs of life are desperately, our soul's purpose is stalking us. And it's usually that we need to stop running away from it.
Right. Yeah, right.
That's true.
Right. You know, it's funny that you say that too, because, you know, working with Teach has also been kind of, a reflection of that truth as well, you know, of trusting your own understanding of your destiny, trusting that you actually have access to the knowledge that you need. And so, you know, a very small example is that before we foolishly got dressed up in our whites, I had a dream that we, you know, where Teach said, you will not get read until the third time. I will not do the divination until the third time you're here. Okay.
Wow.
Pretty straightforward, pretty clear, right? But here is some of the conflict in between what we end up doing in the material reality and what, you know, the other reality is actually attempting to communicate, and the ways in which it becomes easy to ignore or place other expectations on it when you've actually been told something else, because it didn't seem like that made any sense, quote-unquote sense. So, you know, we get there, and it turns out to be true, right? We didn't get read that second time either. We knew better than to show up in our whites by that time, right? But that's just reflecting that the things that are happening and that Teach is instructing in her teachable moments are really deeply already reflections of the things that we already intuitively know, but that not only have those knowledges been colonized and it's difficult to always recognize them or honor them, but also that these are knowledges that happen not alone necessarily. These are things that happen in community. And so those reflections of peers, of elders, of other community members that share that epistemology, that share that way of looking at the world, share that reality, is crucial also to this process of kind of awakening or becoming or starting to walk in line with your purpose.
Absolutely. And sort of this idea of just sort of stepping into that, to that flow, that the conversation taking place between subjective inner knowing and the world reflected back to us, it is
right.
Nonstop, and it's going to be a path of recognizing when we're conscious of it and when we're not, so that we can be more conscious of it as we move forward. Now, we could do an entire year's worth of broadcasts simply on Sherry Moraga, who is simply, and who I know is a mentor to you both, and I have not had the privilege of meeting her in person, but her work has been breathtaking and foundational for my own. Her play, The Hungry Woman, is one of my absolute favorite plays on earth. Could you speak a bit about her influence on this project? Is she someone that you're still in touch with? Is she that you're still communicating with? Is she still having an influence on this work that you're doing moving forward?
Absolutely. And I'd like to also bring in, you know, Sri Moraga's partner, Celia Herrera Rodriguez, who's also been foundational for Cherie's work and subsequently our work. And, you know, we in relationship, obviously in an embodied relationship, we kind of work with the both of them. So yes, in so many ways, we're still very connected. And, you know, unfortunately, we've been a little bit further from the Bay Area, which is where all those lovely folks live, for a while. But, you know, whenever we reconnect, it's kind of a, you know, it feels like a time, like it's time hasn't really passed. So I'm going to just say something really quick, and I want Nia's written, you know, and studied really The Hungry Woman from an intellectual and spiritual perspective. But I'll say, you know, The Hungry Woman fundamentally, I'm going to use that word again, changed my life. You know, I had just gotten to this country. You know, I was about 18, 19 years old at the time that The Hungry Woman was showing at Stanford. I think it was one of one of the few showings that it's had. And I remember, and this is again one of those moments where purpose plays in, right? Purpose walks in. I remember walking out, and a friend of mine walks out, an all white, and she was an older student, African American, from New York. And I was like, why? Well, you know, why are you dressed in all white? And she said, go get your jacket. You know, so here I am, you know, and I was very, you know, tuned into that that stuff at the time, especially because I was just getting just overwhelmed with signals and patterns and things that were happening around me. So I just kind of went and got my jacket, and she said, we're going to this thing. So I didn't even know what this thing was, you know, so I went. It turns out the wonderful Jackie Alexander was speaking right before Sherry Moraga, and you know, this person was had a relationship with Jackie, who's a Yoruba priestess as well, and you know, then we were going to watch the show, and then, you know, etc. And I think for the first time in my life saw myself reflected in that work, particularly with the character Luna, who's kind of more like masculine of center type human, and all of her patterns and relationships to the world that she lives in, and her kind of obsession with, you know, the earth, you know, some of the things that I had been experiencing and some, you know, and had lived as a young person, and, you know, all of that, just being also diasporic, doubly diasporic, you know, and having kind of this incessant desire to put my hand in soil and kind of having this vision of dirt, you know, over and over and over and over again. And here's this play, you know, about the, you know, understanding home, and it's so deeply earth kind of driven, you know. So I just, that's, you know, I didn't know Sri Moraga before that work. And I, you know, that was my first introduction, which I'm sure you know is one, probably the best introduction you could ever get to Sheree's work. And I thought that the questions she was asking were the most important questions that needed to be asked at this time. And I still think they are, you know. And that's the, you know, what eventually, I think Sheree took a sabbatical that next year, and so it took me a year to integrate all that information. And then, you know, I changed my major, I changed my life, you know, completely, and like took a class with Sheree kind of that was it from there. You know, she's been an incredible mentor and also really deeply reinstating for me, because I was a very mythical type writer, you know, would kind of bring me back to this deep place of embodiment. Like, so what do you mean? Like, where is this coming from? you know, you're in your head, you know. So the whole exercise that ultimately I think strengthened through the work with Louisa Teach, you know, started with Sri Muruga from that place, you know, from the place of like sinking down into the body and really examining, you know, some of the harder questions that she would ask, like, you know, what is home? What does home mean? You know, and that catapulted me into, you know, my life's work. So, you know, I think it all started there for me. But I do want Mia to talk a little bit more about that, you know, about the work. So, go ahead.
Well, the other thing, just saying really quickly, I know that the idea of home factors in a great deal across platforms for you both. I would love to hear about that, possibly from you, Nia.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can definitely touch on that. Definitely. So yeah, definitely echoing what Samia is saying in terms of Sheree's just tremendous, tremendous influence. One of the main things that, like, one of the most repeated phrases that Sheree would always say in class and independent meetings and whatever was, you have to go home, you have to go home. And so that certainly has deeply shaped our work. And you know, with all of its complications, right, for example, home for queer bodies might not necessarily be like the most liberatory place, right? So thinking about home, not necessarily only in relationship to physical family home, though not excluding it either, because for those of us that can, some of that work with our families around, you know, recovering knowledge, story, et cetera, as well as healing anti-queer, heteronormative, patriarchal relationships that have been internalized through coloniality, those things are radical in and of themselves, right? But even beyond that, thinking about a larger idea of home as relationship to ancestry, home as relationship to environment, to nature, to the earth, all of our home, right? Home in relationship to the body, home as the body, right? And so all of that thinking certainly has, you know, we're essentially just quoting her, right, for our take us home. And we say that in the website, too, that's really her, that's her saying, right? That's her answer. Well, you have to go home. And it really, I think, home as purpose, you know, home as being in deep alignment with the universe. So definitely that's one of the tremendous lessons that we've learned from her, and it really goes along with the other two major, I think, lessons that we've learned from her, which are that to claim this kind of indigenous identity is a radical act politically, right? That it's not something that and she says this in her essay, Indígena Scribe, that the powers that be want de-Indianized, de-Africanized, de-Asianized bodies, right, for the precise reason of what I said before, an enslaved body has no will of its own. And so, you know, because with those different ways of knowing and that different reclamation of identity comes a different dream, a dream that is perhaps in counter to the American dream of consumption and success. And, you know, the last is just she's provided really like a conscious model of how to live. Just like we can like watch her live and her and Celia live and the integration with which they merge the spiritual, the political, the embodied is like the earth-based is inspiring, just really, really inspiring to watch. And so just in that really simple, humble way, we're really indebted to them.
And the concept of home, and I know that you were also talking about, a few things came up. Samia was talking about how she had just arrived in this country when she was presented with Sheree Muruga's work, and we're also talking about the de-Africanizing and de-Asianizing of bodies sort of toward an easily controlled homogeneity. There's the word balade, which means homegrown, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yeah, it's I can talk more about it, but let me know. Go ahead.
But there's also an element here of Black, and I would just love for this to be made known, this deeper undercurrent to some of your work, which has to do with Black-Arab relations, something that I don't have much knowledge of historically, but I know that you've made mention of some places on your website and in your work. Is that something you can speak more to, the connection between Arab people and Black people, and how that connection is made present in your endeavors?
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to first, acknowledge the some of the modern day kind of political work that's happening, at least, you know, and I'm going to speak to the Lebanese context more specifically, around, you know, workers' rights and domestic workers' rights, precisely, you know, specifically. And when we talk about domestic workers, we're generally talking about people of darker skin, you know, from Southeast Asia, from the African continent, et cetera. And so there's you know, all of the feminist, radical, leftist, queer, you know, et cetera, groups in the Lebanese context are invested in dismantling the really, you know, the horrible system that's been set up for domestic workers in the region. And so we've got that, you know, as an outgrowth of some of the stuff. But, you know, historically speaking, and this is something, you know, interestingly enough, I've seen so much work emerge, you know, about, you know, the African diaspora all around the world in different ways. And it almost seems a little bit more silenced in the Arab world. You know, the origin, our origins. I'm going to go that far and, you know, but, you know, there's a wonderful article, and I have to remember the name of the author, unfortunately, called, I think, the Blackness in My Mother's Face or something, that was written by a Palestinian woman writer, incredible, that came out recently. I have to, unfortunately, don't remember the name of the author right now. But the, in essence, really, you know, I think that there's a deeply severed relationship that has happened in the past, with regards to, I think, what is the precursor to the transatlantic slave trade. Also, you know, if you Google that on Amazon, you probably find 3 books on it. You know, even though it's, you know, it's one of the fundamental reasons why the transatlantic slave trade was successful. You know, because I think what happened in the dismantling, I think the dismantling from the Arab perspective was so deep, because it was, if I understand correctly, and this is, you know, I'm still fairly ignorant about the subject and, you know, wanting to do more work, but is fundamentally, you know, built around women, you know, and destroying, you know, the womanhood, you know, because it primarily focused on getting, you know, concubines over to the Arab world, getting, you know, primarily women over to the Arab world. And so when you break that, you're breaking the fabric, you know, you're breaking the fabric of the community. And a lot of, there was so much loss, I think, in terms of the you know, physical loss in the process of the Arab, you know, slavery, that it completely weakened and prepared kind of in a way, you know, the environment to be, you know, abused and taken advantage of by, you know, by the Europeans. So, you know, and we don't talk about that. We highlight the power of, you know, Islam and renouncing slavery and all of these wonderful things, you know, but slavery is well and alive, you know, in our world, especially in the regions of the Gulf, where, you know, where slavery was mostly occurring, you know, in being translated, you know, up north. But it's, you know, I can't put this lightly, but it's still a taboo subject, you know, to bring up, obviously, kind of like in, you know, the Latin American context, all of that. But I feel like it's even more taboo, you know. And I think that the reason it's more taboo, and this is, you know, a universal cosmological kind of, you know, understanding or explanation maybe, is that it's at the source, right? It's the and I always say this about that world, you know, is there's a lot of stuff that has happened there that needs to be unpacked, and we're you know so kind of intersectional, you know, as human beings in that region, that, you know, it's kind of like the projection of what could happen, you know, thousands of years from now on this side of the world. You know, it's almost like there's a center from which it's kind of occurring, and not in a you know, more progressive or regressive kind of way, but more in a like timeline of cycles and patterns and, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's deeply, you know, and as we say, you know, the philosophical in our world, in Yanai's world, somehow we always, you know, everything that we do is deeply embodied. And so you're talking about a biracial, you know, Arab black, you know, relationship. I mean, we're together, in case, you know, the people that need to know that. But, you know, we're physically together in an embodied sense. And, you know, I won't tell you that these issues, you know, don't come up, you know. And so, you know, we live that out in our day-to-day lives, and we have to deal with it on a personal level. We have to deal with it on a universal level. And if, you know, I think that the, you know, not to be cliche, you know, but if we can understand it in this embodied kind of way, and see each other in this embodied kind of way, then there are, you know, there's going to be some deeper healing occurring, you know, outside of the two of us, at least, you know, or you know, where everything's going. But yeah, I'm not particularly proud of, you know, of that history and, you know, of the, unfortunately. So that's, you know, that's where it's at.
Well, thank you so much for that really deep explanation and insight into an important factor when it comes to understanding the transatlantic slave trade and African history that I know that most of our listeners don't have any concept of, and how you are re-envisioning that history, not rewriting it, but re-envisioning what the karmic intensity, the baggage of that history can mean in terms of moving forward collaboratively. We're going to take a quick musical break, and I cannot wait to continue this conversation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You are listening to another fine production of the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ollie. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. This is the longest-running conjure show on the planet and may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner. Starring Candelo Cambisa and Malik Cambisa, this is the voice of authentic Cuban Palo and Dominican Sanse in the United States, with special guests representing the entire range of African traditional and diasporic religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Tuesdays, a pair of outstanding hosts point the way to essential values. First, on the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance in the practical use of crystals and crystal balls for the development of mental concentration, mind power, divination, and telepathic communication. His show airs Tuesday evenings from 5 to 6 o'clock Pacific Time. Once you have your bearings, engage in activism and social justice in the streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly brings listeners front-page reports on the ongoing struggle for racial, gender, and social justice, shedding much light on civil and social rights issues. Her cry for freedom begins at 6 p.m. Pacific Time and inspires us for 1 hour. On Wednesdays, Andrea Weston's Liquid Libations pour forth to bless us with poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances. If you are a poet or someone who simply enjoys the beauty and power of words, then Liquid Libations welcomes your participation. Call in and read your work. Listen for Liquid Libations on Wednesdays from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Pacific Time. On Thursdays, from deep in the heart of Texas, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the silver-tongued professor shares his knowledge of roots and delivers the lucky numbers. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern. Tax and license may apply. Train departure times and Burma Shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company is based in sunny Forestville, California, and provides traditional spiritual products for remediating all kinds of conditions. Locate them online at luckymojo.com or visit them in person to see the world's smallest church, Missionary Independent Spiritual Church. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone who is in the chat room and listening to us live, and those who will be listening to the show in its archived form. This is your host, Kai Armand of On Sacred Ground on the LMC Radio Network. Today we have guests Balade Black and Soli Rose, and we are discussing such incredible topics right now. We are looking at purpose. We're looking at reflection and what it means to see yourself reflected in the world around you. We're talking about going home and what it means to go home and find yourself in a place that is both familiar and right for you. We're talking about intersectionality. And we're talking about seeing each other in a more embodied way. And we're also getting a wonderful sort of general overview of the incredible work that two elders, Chief Louisa Teach and playwright and artist and activist and theorist, Sherry Moraga, have brought to our world. So if you don't know these names, please look them up and look up their work. And if you're in the chat room, a number of links regarding these two individuals' works have been posted. So please check these people out. So coming back to Balade Black, the two founders of this organization, Nia and Samia, I know that you also go by another name that we were just blessed by one of the projects thereof, Soli Rose.
Yes, our other identity.
Yeah, we'll talk to us about this incredible musical phenomenon.
Well, Samia and I came together originally through music, through the avenue of music. And, you know, I don't know, we both were really interested in the power of music and the power of sound to kind of not only recover knowledge, but to kind of move things in the world. And we both were also, if you can't tell from all of our other work, very both invested in ancestral knowledge and ancestral ways of being. And also coming from a deep place, I think, for both of us of mourning, really, our ancestors, mourning the connection that we may have felt, mourning the things that we were not told, the things that were not said. And so music kind of became a way for us to... and we have both, you know, different ancestries, as we talked about, but also I also have a Sephardic Jewish by way of Turkey ancestry. And so we also had that kind of linkage. So it wasn't completely two completely separate worlds. And so music became our way to kind of coat that journey of looking back, or to coat that journey of kind of moving into this other phase of our lives where we would be not so far away anymore from that which we had lost. And so Soli Rose, in the spirit of that idea, is Soli is the name of my great-great-grandmother on my maternal side, who's Turkish and Sephardic Turkish, and Rose is the name of Samia's grandmother, both of whom, obviously, my great-great-grandmother had passed, and Samia's grandmother also who had passed. And, you know, so also the connection and maternal grandmother for Samia. So the connection to our maternal lines and the connection between female lines and remembering and the kinds of remembering that doesn't necessarily get publicized or archived or valued even enough to be elevated. But so you can see some of the similar threads of impulse in the music as well. And so, you know, and the sound just kind of grew organically, and we believe that we come from traveling people and that they were already crossing, right? We only hear about crossing and traveling in relationship to European colonialism in so many ways, because they were the ones that had the technology to make the boats, and those of us who are a little more aware know that that's not the case, right? There's considerable evidence for the presence of Africans in the Americas before the slave trade, and, you know, the Phoenicians traveling everywhere, and, you know, a lot of peoples were traveling. There are many, many boat-making sea peoples that were traveling before European colonialism, and so really, and also traveling by foot, walking, and really embodying kind of a nomadic way of life. And so understanding that regardless of that we have, like, a lot of contemporary and also century, you know, since the beginning of this millennia conflict within our peoples, but also that there is a point at which they were traveling, a point at which they were interrelating, and a point at which they were that the sounds crossed, each other, and you can hear it in the music. And so the music that we're doing is really a reflection of both of our ancestries. A lot of it involves Samia playing the oud, the ancestor of the lute, and me vocalizing in ways that, you know, I trained as a singer in a Western way for a part of my life, and at one point thought I was going to be, you know, at the Metropolitan Opera, on Broadway, these kinds of venues. And so it's really kind of training towards that. But me vocalizing in a way kind of antithetical to how I was taught to use my voice, in a way that I kind of came to use my voice through our musical interaction. So that's just kind of a start.
Yeah. If I may say something, I want to say that was very much, I guess, the sound and music to me, well, to us, and to, I think, the, you know, a lot of people in the world, it's the shape maker, you know, and it's kind of like that, you know, brings the vision from a place of vision into this dimension. I kind of see that as a bridge. And so for us, I think it created our relationship in so many ways. And I want to also say, we were talking about the transatlantic slave trade and, you know, Arabs and slavery and all of that. A lot of the stuff that, you know, I shared comes from Nia's, Nia's work, intellectual and historical scholarly work, research around, that was sparked really by our relationship.
That was sparked by our relationship, because how am I to be with this person if I don't know how we have walked?
And that was, I guess so much, I don't want to say smoothed, but it was, aided by creating kind of ritual space with the music. And so I see the music as kind of this, this soothing balm, almost that helped, it's helping the baby come out, whatever the baby is. But, and maybe even, dealing with some of the deeper trauma and, all that. And, I'd love to say that we're constant practitioners of the sound arts, but unfortunately it's like a fluctuating thing for us. We're just so busy and exhausted all the time. We're trying to regain kind of a footing, most days. But it's definitely a practice that, is our survival practice. And I was, that was shared with me early on in some of the first reading work that I've gotten as well personally. And so, so that Nia, get that information as well. So, it's I think that the shaper of all of our work. And, sometimes we'll forget about it and then be reminded very, very strongly, and kind of like a slap across the face. Like, you've got to do this, you can't leave it behind. It's the at the heart and, source of everything else that emanates, out of it. So,
and also it was funny, Kai, that you're bringing them up together now in this interview in a way that we haven't really recently done, because, that was a tremendous component of the Elders Project, because for those of us that know, when you go see an elder, you don't go empty-handed, you have an offering for that elder. And so the music was actually going to be, our Soli Rose music was going to be our offering and our kind of currency, really, of exchange in order to, and it also has served as a bridge to elders. I mean, a lot of these relationships have been solidified with our music, in terms of the traveling ceremonial work we did with Shui and Celia and their incredible project, La Semilla Caminante, that turned into the piece New Fire that premiered at Brava a couple of years ago in San Francisco, and also with Tish and other ways doing ceremonial work. So that it not only bridges our own connection, but also kind of serves as an embodied way to offer something to those whose knowledge we benefit so much from.
Incredible, and I agree with everything you're saying. I'm like feverishly writing down notes, and I'm like, I can't cover all of this, but I love that you use the word currency, just as I was writing down one of the driving quotes of my undergraduate studies was Gary Snyder's quote, "Performance is currency in the deep world's gift economy." And that these embodied ways of being, of performance as an actual, performance as we understand it in the Western context, but also embodied ways of being, mimicry, gesture, that these actually mean so much as we give to elders, as we give to the unseen world, as we give to the spirit world. These gifts from the 3D lens, this is what we have to offer. So us being fully entrenched here in the 3D world, fully entrenched here in our bodies and in embodied ways, is one of the best gifts we can give to others, including others unseen. And I also love how Soli Rose contains both the energies of migration and of coming home, of home being embodied in it, in both of them. I think that there's so much room for, as we were talking before, about radical ways of viewing systems so that we can step out of them and create something new, that often requires, as you said before, antithetical ways of seeing the work we're doing, of seeing the work we're producing. And I know what you mean by, as an artist, feeling that slap across the face, that saying, hey, get back to work, this is important to your survival.
But I mean, there's also potential for re-envisioning what it means to be productive, what it means to be a sort of a productive artist, what it means to be a producer, that maybe what you've produced to this point is exactly what you've needed to produce so far.
Right.
And it's certainly a blessing. I mean, I would love for you to have 3 albums by now, and I know that everyone in the chat room would as well, because everyone's saying, who is this? Oh, my gosh. And I'm like, that is Holy Rose. But, you know, that's, you know, you're two human beings with a lot on your plate as you are finding, really creating, you're creating vehicles for your own soul's purpose as you've discovered them so far, for which we are both extremely grateful. Nia mentioned that Samya plays the descendant of the lute. Where did you learn this growing up as a child? Where is this coming? Could you actually say the name of this instrument one more time?
Of course. I'm gonna, you know, keep it short, but it's the oud, and oud in Arabic means branch or stick, or, you know, I guess stick, I'm trying to remember what, but, you know, there's the story goes that, you know, this instrument maker, you know, son died or daughter died, and, you know, he hung them in the tree to kind of go back to the land of the ancestors, and from that the oud was born. And, you know, it's kind of the way it's shaped, you know, it's got the belly, you know, and the navel, you know, in the middle, and the nerves, you know, the strings are the nerves, and then the pegs are the fingers and the hand, you know, the fingers, you know, or the off of the feet and hands. And so so there's, you know, that going on. And in terms of playing, you know, playing it, I walked into the oud, I think, interestingly enough, I think when you leave home, you know, you, you know, which is an act, I think, I think Gregory Cahete says something about, you know, the necessity to leave and gain perspective, and not in a colonial kind of way, which is, you know, something we could talk about for seven, you know, for hours, but in a grounded nomadic kind of way, which we were, you know, mentioned earlier. Yeah.
And Gloria Antaldúa as well talks about that. Very influential, both of those folks. And, you know, so when I left, I played the keys, you know, keyboard, and a little bit of guitar, just very little bit. But I started having these kind of, like, intensified desires to hear this instrument again and to hold it and to feel the vibration of the sound against my body. Not that the piano doesn't do that, but there was something a lot more intimate with that instrument. And so I started having dreams about it. I went home that summer, and I took a two-week crash course with a student at the conservatory in Lebanon, and he was very, very generous with me. You know, I remember I was telling some friends of mine, we, like, bought the oud, and then I was sitting in the back of the car, and all of a sudden my fingers just kind of knew what to do. And this is not boasting or anything, but just, I think it was already part of my path and my work, you know, so deeply, because there's something very intuitive about it, with, you know, to me. So that's the, you know, that's that. And I, you know, I've been teaching myself, but I'm not a traditionally, like, classically trained oud player. And just to kind of also add that, you know, where the oud is a very classical instrument in the Arab world. It's like, you know, the equivalent of, you know, the violin or, like, you know, something like that. So it's not very, like, subversive. It's not like the drum, you know, or something like that. But, you know, the way I'm playing it is very inspired by these, what I was really getting trained by West African drummers at the time. And so it's very inspired by, you know, Mali blues and, you know, West African sound. And so it was like North African type, you know, mixtures where, you know, some of that sound actually mixes with the Arab influence and flamenco and all of that. And so, you know, the rhythmic nature of it and all that is definitely not traditional Arabic. You know, it's more probably, you know, it's closer to North African music. So, you know, it's been an interesting journey for me with that instrument. But I'm hoping that it will role when the time is right. And so I'm, like you said, I'm just accepting what everything is, you know, but that's that.
Well, just you're engaged, you know, everything we've been discussing, it's so microcosm, macrocosm, just your engagement with this one instrument holds so much regarding what we've been talking about all episode in terms of challenging norms and coming home through migration. It's just phenomenal, and it's just so obvious that you both are walking your path in a way that is truly inspiring for anyone who has the privilege of being in your presence or hearing what you have to say about the world. So again, thank you so much for, because I know that walking one's path comes with trials and comes with a lot of stumbling. Sometimes it's crawling along one's path. So I thank you for having survived and endured all that has led to the wisdom that you have today and all that you will survive, endure, and cherish on your way forward. So what can people expect from, well, first of all, can people still engage with Validate Black's current project with Chief Louis Satish? Is there still time? Can people run over to validate.black right now and sign up?
Yes, actually they can, and we hope that they do. We hope that they kind of check out our website and learn more about our approach specifically to this business. I think people kind of got to hear our philosophies on the world a little bit, but yeah, definitely to learn more specifically about this project, Chief Louisa Tisch, it still has an offering that's definitely available. We actually still, the offering is 8 video classes, and 11 live web classes that will take place once a month, and a series of also visualizations that go along with those video classes. And so it's a whole product, and we actually haven't even started the first February live class. So if they get in now, they will have access to all 11 web classes. Folks that join in March would have access to 10, and so on and so forth. We did have a sale that's no longer active, but what we do have now is we just recently posted by request 2 payment plan options so that folks that are not able or choose not to pay the full price up front, which is $127, can just divide it into either 3 months or 2 months. So, yeah, it's definitely something that if any of this spoke to the listeners out there, we would love for them to go learn more about the project.
And Tisch covers the fundamentals. And I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, wonder if this is for them, or, you know, am I too advanced for this? Is it, you know, am I too, you know, young for this? Am I too this for this? I always say the same thing. It's like, if you don't cover the fundamentals, you know, it's like what, you know, same with music or whatever. You know, if you don't really know how to pluck that string, you know, you can play, you know, all sorts of things, and the instrument would never sound good. And so it's kind of like a, you know, for me, it's a fine tuning of the fundamentals, you know, and that's what At the Crossroads is. You know, it's the beginning. That's why it's the first project. That's why it's called At the Crossroads. That's why it's with Chief Louis Satish, who's a maverick, really a wonderful, you know, revolutionary, really, in her field. I mean, and if you know her life story, I mean, it's kind of ridiculously fantastic, you know what I'm saying? But, like,
documentary.
Right, you know, we want to document, you know, document her life. But it is, and we tried to make it as affordable as possible so that our communities can have access to it. And we've instated the payment plan, you know, and all sorts of things like that, you know, in the spirit of what it is that Validate Black does. But, you know, the point is to ultimately, you know, we'd love to bring Tisch around and physically to different locations, you know, do actual, like, in-person, you know, ritual and ceremony work and workshops and, you know, that kind of thing. But we've started with something very kind of, I guess, strategic for us right now in terms of how to, you know, build community and get people engaged and, you know,
I just want to say also quickly that, you know, one of the lessons and one of the things that we're really kind of grounded by is that the initial idea that became, you know, African American studies departments and Chicano studies departments, that one of the things that Sheree Maraga taught us is, you know, about the idea of a third world college or an institution of education outside of the academy, as it's known, right, was the vision. And that became like AfroAM departments, Black Studies, you know, Native American Studies within the larger kind of Euro-dominant institutions. That's what that became. You know, HBCUs have a slightly different trajectory, right? But that really kind of, that idea, I think, really inspires both of us. What would it mean to really create spaces for education outside of these, you know, the ivory tower? And because of the digital world now, as much as it's problematic for all these other reasons, it also has the potential for us to access each other in ways that we haven't before. And that's been talked about with the kind of Twitter revolution and all the ways in which that's informed the Black Lives Matter movement and et cetera. But also, how can that also infuse the spiritual movement, the spiritual political movement, right? And really thinking through how is it that we can kind of galvanize this online community, because the whole point of the live classes and this, you know, the group that we're going to do is that people can experience this work together and have a sense of community, a sense of accountability, and also a sense of connecting with people who are maybe in their locales to do this work together. Some folks have already told us about some of the wonderful things that are happening up in Harlem. Shout out to them that are meeting in groups to do this work together collectively. And then how we can then, as Belle de Black, enter, you know, help with that process by doing more site-specific work with various differently geographically based people, or organizing retreats of the Belle de Black community and things like that.
And our next offering is actually right around the corner. So we're busy at work right now preparing for that. So, you know, if you're interested in any way, please, you know, get in touch with us, stay tuned, you know, sign up.
If you don't buy the product, sign up for the list we can keep you posted.
We've got a really wonderful, wonderful elder coming up next, and I'm not going to reveal who it is now, but I think it's going to be really amazing experience for all of us. So
if Kai lets us, we'll come back and tell you about it.
Please do. Trust me, you'll be back. You'll be back. You'll be back. No, I am so grateful for your being on the show today. We have got about 2.5 minutes left, and I definitely actually want to close out with one of Soli Rose's other tracks, Zombie. But thank you so much for being here, and and people are in the chat room saying, we want them back. So I truly, from the bottom of my heart, you both are home for me. So thank you. Thank you so much for being here, and also reminding me of so much of what's important to me and the kind of people that I need to remain connected to. So thank you, and we will absolutely have you back on. Thank you so much for everything.
Thank you, Kai. This was wonderful.
You're
amazing. You're an inspiration.
You're on your path as well.
Yeah.
Keep it up.
Thank you. Thank you, listeners, again, for being here for this wonderful interview with the founders of Belle de Black and the members of Soli Rose, who in their talk with us today, one of the things that they mentioned that really stuck with me was, how are we to be with one another if we don't know how we've walked? And I think that's so much of what this show is about. How are we to be with one another if we don't know where we've walked? And we don't live in a world right now that encourages us to know where we have walked as individuals and with one another. That being said, this has been another episode of On Sacred Ground with your host, Kai Armand. Tune in next week when we will have our guest, the wonderful and wise Conjureman Ali. Until then, keep a light in your window for courage in our times. I'll be keeping a light in mine. Thanks again for joining us.